From Reclaim the Media in Seattle and the Northwest Community Radio Network, it's Listen Up Northwest. Each week we bring you a roundup of stories from communities throughout our region. I'm your host, Yuko Kadama. By some accounts, our media landscape is growing day by day with the expansion of broadband internet into rural areas and hundreds of cable and satellite TV channels. For many, a cell phone is also a radio, a portable stereo, and an internet communications tool. But while tools like YouTube and blogs have arguably contributed to an explosion of media democracy, it remains true that a small handful of media companies still hold a disproportionate amount of control over what we see, hear, and read every day. It's worth the trouble to explore how our media systems work and for whom. On today's show, we look at the power of media and communications and how people are making their own media and working to change the policies that shape this landscape. First, we visit with Real Girls in Seattle, a media training program for young people that combines critical media analysis with production skills. And how do American-made media policies affect music fans and artists in Canada? Digital copyright rules are up for debate this fall in the Canadian Parliament. And the American Civil Liberties Union has been carefully watching over the intersection of technology and our rights. Find out what trends they're tracking in Washington State. All this and more coming up on this week's edition of Listen Up Northwest. We begin today's show with a feature on high school girls working on a unique after-school media and technology program. Real Girls teaches media literacy as well as media production skills. In this case, a group of young filmmakers in training take a critical look at media portrayals of women and experience for themselves how the camera can be used to interrupt negative stereotypes as well as create more positive images. The next piece is produced by students and staff of Real Girls and narrated by Camille Kolodziejewski.
Real Girls is a Seattle-based nonprofit after-school program teaching media literacy and filmmaking to teenage girls. Longtime participants and youth media makers Camille Kolodziejewski and Monica Olson recently documented a signature Real Girls program addressing the overlapping issues of girls, sexuality, and the media.
How naked, oh how naked are we gonna get? How naked, oh how naked, how naked are we?
Advertisements influence us. Here's Real Girls participant Mia Karpov.
Every day we are bombarded with thousands of advertisements, but what exactly are the advertisers trying to sell us? Are they simply trying to sell a product, or is the product inconsequential and the real objective is to sell us a mindset that would make us, the public, more eager consumers?
Executive Director and founder Mallory Graham explains why interpreting media is essential to understanding the challenges of young women today.
There are so many important issues that face young women in our society. You know, everything from eating disorders to date rape, violence against women, and you can look at all these issues and really find a core root in the problem in how media represents women. We had the girls create what we called a wall of shame, where they took out ads from magazines and wrote all over them and critiqued them.
Looking at the wall of shame in mid-creation, the ads that the girls have chosen are not remarkable, but tacked up together, they are shocking. Women stare into the camera while pulling their shirts down, lie near naked between the legs of a fully clothed businessman, and stand next to a giant piece of raw meat. Their body parts are visually cut up and reassembled, and over, men are shown fully clothed and gazing at near-naked women. Real Girls participants Jay Conrad and others talked about what the wall of shame meant to them.
It was an exercise that helped us to recognize just how completely women are objectified in media, especially in advertisements, and especially how our sexuality is exploited through these advertisements.
I liked shouting back at the advertisements going, "Hey, that's not right, that's not cool."
And shout back at the media they did, scribbling such accusations and questions as, "Why do clothing ads have no clothes? We're not all that pale. What's wrong with looking over 30? Get the shoes, get the girl. Is this how we're supposed to look? What are they selling? And who wants to look like a skeleton anyway?"
They do that to women. It's degrading. We're just able to, like, recognize the kind of images that we feel like we're supposed to be like and we know that we don't have to be.
Real Girls also seeks to question our complex relationships as cultural consumers to advertisements, a question well voiced by participant Cora Turner.
If you're saying, well, these women are exploiting themselves, well, you're exploiting them too by looking at them and keep buying the magazines over and over again.
How naked are we gonna get? Yeah. How naked? Oh, how naked? How naked are we gonna get? On beyond the bootstrap.
Mallory Graham reminds us that the goal of this exercise is for young women to question the effects of media on their own self-images.
Then from there, we kind of looked a little bit more at existing media and how it affects how we feel about ourselves.
Real Girls is an intergenerational learning experience. Here, a mentor asks the young women during the Wall of Shame exercise how they relate to the images they're seeing, and participants Cora Turner and Rose Stiffarm respond.
I'm wondering where the race representation is and how that feels for girls that aren't white to look in magazines and see only images of the white and the powerful staring back at you.
I don't identify with these women in the magazine, so they're really not portraying me.
Native women are not portrayed in like fashion magazines ever unless they're like wearing some obscure leather outfit with crazy colorful beads and colorful feathers.
Graham and Real Girls mentor Kat Velos talk about taking this exercise in media representation to the next step, empowering young women to make their own media.
To us, it was really important as part of Real Girls to make the connections between social issues and how media perpetuates them.
Real Girls peer mentors and participants echo the power of this dynamic. Stacey Robinson and a first-time attendee have the last words.
Definitely opens my eyes to how much I can do and how much one person can definitely change.
And just seeing like what people can really do when they want to make a change and have the power. And I mean, the influence of a camera is huge. And to be able to just take that and make your own message, I think, just really has really proven something to me.
I really hope these girls have, you know, opened their eyes and kind of realized, hey, you know, I can do something.
By doing something, Real Girls become cultural producers rather than just cultural consumers, using visual storytelling and professional filmmaking skills to make their voices heard. Check out what the Real Girls do with their newfound power by watching some of their past work at www.youtube.com/realgirls. This report was made possible with the support of Reed Kennan, Lila Kataev, and Yuko Kodama. Music was donated by The Blow. Voice work by Camille Kolajewski. Learn more about Real Girls at www.realgirls.org. That's www.reelgrrls.org.
All the girls are sitting on a pile of gold. All the girls and the boys, you know they want it. They want all the girls are sitting on a pile of gold. All the girls and the boys, you know they want it. They want it, want it.
We take you from Seattle Youth to Canadian Parliament. As broadband internet access slowly expands, along with the popularity of peer-to-peer file sharing services such as LimeWire and BitTorrent, debates over digital media and copyright policy have gathered steam in both the U.S. and Canada. The Canadian Parliament is considering a bill which would impose stiff penalties on music fans for copying music or attempting to circumvent so-called digital locks on music files. Charlotte Bourne of CJSF in Burnaby, British Columbia, has this story.
On June 12th, Industry Minister Jim Prentice introduced Bill C-61, an amendment to the Copyright Act. It is an attempt to deal with the new complexities of copyright law in Canada in the wake of changes brought on by the Internet over the last 10 years. Albert Cloutier, Director of the Copyright and International Intellectual Property Policy Directorate of Industry Canada, explains what this bill means for consumers.
There are a number of pro-consumer provisions. Generally speaking, there will be a new provision that allows the recording of television shows for more convenient viewing. There will be the ability to make backup copies, if you will, of legally acquired books, newspapers, video cassettes, and photographs onto various other digital devices. In terms of music, there's a specific provision that will allow people to copy the music that they legally own onto the devices that they own, such as MP3 players or cell phones or hard drives.
In addition to new pro-consumer provisions, Cloutier explains some of the digital rights granted to copyright holders, such as artists, musicians, and filmmakers.
One of the rights that would be granted is the ability to control the presence of material on networks such as the Internet. This is known as a making available right. Another important digital or Internet-based right relates to the use of what are called technological protection measures or digital locks. So basically, if a rights holder decides to control access or use of their work using a digital lock, they will have the backing of the law if somebody tries to circumvent that digital lock.
Jeffrey Glass is the Vancouver Chapter Coordinator of Fair Copyright for Canada. As he explains, the use of digital locks can affect how consumers use the media and technology they have purchased.
The so-called digital locks that are protected by the law are actually features of technological devices like cell phones and computers, and they can control and limit what those devices can do, regardless of whether any copyright material is involved. So, for example, the law makes it illegal to unlock your cell phone to use with a different provider. The prohibition on opening these locks means that consumers lose the right to control the devices they own. It also means that they cannot work with the media they have paid for without breaking the law. Law-abiding consumers will find themselves locked out of the technology and the content they've paid for. There's another problem, which is whoever controls the locks controls the distribution channels. That means that the big media and technology companies, who are mostly American, will have a lot of control over who can distribute what. That takes power away from artists, and I think it's really bad for a country like ours, which is quite concerned about our cultural independence.
There could also be unintended consequences for artists.
What really worries me is the effect on legitimate activity. Artists and innovators, they produce their work for public consumption, so they can't run around breaking the law. So if the law says they can't have access to public domain materials because those are protected by digital locks, say to satirize film clips and so on, then they have to follow the law. So in my opinion, they have the most to lose.
Bill C-61 has been tabled until Parliament resumes in the fall.
That was produced at CJSF by Charlotte Bourne. To the United States, a number of groups are paying close attention to policy debates at the intersection of technology and civil liberties. Peter Marshall of KBCS interviews Christina Drummond, project director of the Washington State ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project.
What was the rationale for the project?
The project exists really to look at how we can embrace technologies that foster civil liberties and how we can also protect our civil liberties going forward as government agencies, private agencies, implement technology. We have a number of areas that we work on, the first of which is informational privacy. So if you think in terms of data and how much information is out there about you, in today's world, that information is electronic. And as computers have gotten cheaper and more powerful, you can store all of it, you can analyze it, you can share it very easily. So we're looking at how do you protect privacy in this world where information is out there and moving so quickly. The second area is freedom of expression and speech, the internet being the classic example today. Library filtering is an example where adults have difficulty finding information on public computers because of various filtering technologies, and the filters should be disabled so people can get to that information. When we have a new technology, people just forget that the information behind the technology is the same. You know, it's censoring an internet website is no different than censoring a book, if you think of it in those terms. But often people hear internet and think it's a new issue. So we come in and lobby for the Bill of Rights.
How about some examples?
One of the things is working on video surveillance in Seattle City Parks. This is something that right now has been discussed between both the mayor and city council. And before these cameras go up, you can really have an opportunity to look at what are the policies behind that. And to be clear, the ACLU doesn't think there should be any cameras. They don't deter crime. They don't actually make people more safe compared to especially other options like lighting or having an officer or a person in the park with authority. That said, when cameras are in place, you can also have privacy safeguards, looking at who has access to that footage, how long is that footage held. So that's one area that we've been advocating for protections if these cameras do end up going into place. A second project that is a good example is a project called ORCA. This is a project that is going to impact transit users, public transit in King, Pierce, Snohomish, Kitsap counties. The goal is to make the payment more efficient. And to do that, you're going to have one card that you can use across buses, trains, ferries. The challenge is, in using that card, you're creating data. So there will be information about the time, the route, the date on where you use this card. So again, we've been advocating to put protections into place as to who can see that data. We don't think it's necessarily appropriate for your employer, if they provide you with a FlexPass, for example, to have the ability to see everywhere you've used your pass, the date, the time, the route, especially on evenings and weekends when you're not working.
What's coming up for the project?
One of the things that we're looking at for this coming fall is to actually do some work around students and their use of technology. Kids now run around with cell phones, taking pictures, taking videos, texting each other, and cyberbullying is a concern. One of the things we wanted to do was put together a framework or a guide, really, so that students and parents understand what the rights are for their children with regard to privacy and free speech.
Christina, what do you find that might be particularly scary about the kinds of issues the Technology and Liberty Project engages with?
Definitely one of the things that's concerning and keeps me up at night is the way that piece by piece, the infrastructure for surveillance, the infrastructure that can curb our ability to speak and express ourselves freely, and that changes behavior, is being put into place. And often we don't connect the dots, per se, to see what we're left with. Video surveillance, filtering technology on the internet, facial recognition technology, RFID. When you put it all together, you have all of the pieces to do some pretty scary things. And, you know, often I think of this in terms of the lobster sitting in the pot and the water is slowly heating, but the lobster isn't concerned. As a society, we need to start thinking about the big picture by connecting the dots and recognize that now is the time that we really need to be vigilant and teach our children that these are important issues, because at the same time, while the system is being put into place, you also have an entire generation growing up with this as the norm. And if we lose the expectation of privacy because in their eyes, video surveillance is normal, tracking of my location is normal, the ability to not see stuff on the internet is normal, or to have what I look at be monitored as normal, then it's really changed society. That's something that keeps me up at night.
That was ACLU Technology and Liberty Project Director Christina Drummond, interviewed by Peter Marshall of KBCS. Haven's Tips was the engineer. Adrian Valladares Carranza is a member of PECUN, a union representing tree planters and farm workers based in Woodburn, Oregon. He was a leader in the union's project to build their low-power FM radio station, KPCN. Broadcasting with the slogan Radio Movimiento, KPCN is the only station in Oregon owned by a labor union and a primary source for news and culture for immigrant families in that region. Valladares Carranza described the importance of independent local media for his community at last year's FCC media ownership hearing in Seattle.
Before I continue, I want to do something that I want to welcome all of you to do with me, and it's called the Campesino Clap. The Campesino Clap is when we all applaud together and become in a unison, and when we all are in a unison, we yell, si se puede. And if you can say, si se puede, go ahead. So, ready? So KPCN is PECUN's radio station. PECUN, PCUN, Tree Planters and Farm Workers United of the Northwest, is the Oregon's largest Latino organization in a town where 50% of the community is Latino. I'm here today not just to tell you about the amazing work that our independent, locally owned radio station does, but talk about how corporate control of media and lack of access to our own airwaves has impacted our struggle to protect our rights and build our community in the Willamette Valley. KPCN is not just only a Latino-owned radio station in Woodburn. We are the only station in Oregon owned by a labor union. Over our 30 years of history, in order to communicate with the Latino community, we have to pay to this time in the air. So we use a commercial radio station, AM, KWBY, La Pantera. To make the story short, we got kicked out, shut down. We didn't get to finish the list time. But we needed to do this because of our communities. We need to talk about the voting issues. We needed to organize them for the better rights in the fields. And it taught us something. What it taught us was that now that we own our radio station, we can see how important it is to have this media capacity. Why? Because it is amazing to see how media has many positive effects in our today's minority communities, which already has tons of struggles to deal with. As an example, I can tell you that we have an indigenous programming that allows them to communicate in their native tongue, not in Spanish, not English, and this opportunity do not have a price. This is priceless.
That was Adrian Valladares Carranza of KPCN, Low Power FM in Woodburn, Oregon, speaking at a public FCC hearing last November. The piece was recorded by the KBCS Public Affairs team. Grassroots and independent media have the ability to tell stories that are often sidelined by mainstream media outlets. For this reason, community radio and public access TV news, alternative newspapers and magazines, and news-gathering blogs are all vitally important parts of our media landscape. For many people, the 1999 WTO demonstrations in Seattle were a watershed moment demonstrating the significance of grassroots public interest media. The following is an experience shared by Clint Spiegel, an assistant professor of biochemistry at Western Washington University. In November 1999, he attended the WTO protests. Joe Bolduc of KBCS contributed the story.
I was in my early 20s, and I had lived in Seattle for a few months and met a few people who were concerned with WTO, which I didn't actually know that much about. And I decided that I would go with them. So I went down to Seattle Center, and it was neat to see all the different ages of people that were involved, because you'd have people that were of my age all the way up to ages 50 and 60, people that really cared about being in the unions they were in. We marched till we reached the Westlake Center. That is where basically all hell had started to break loose. There were so many people down there. There were people even hanging off some of the walls of the buildings. There were a couple kids that were climbing on top of the Nike Town sign, and they'd started to do some destruction of the property. One of the older guys that was marching with AFL-CIO started yelling at him because it was counterproductive for what people were trying to do. I've never participated in anything like that before, and to walk up and see the tenseness between the police officers and some of the peaceful protesters and then the other people that were causing a little bit of mischief. I'd never seen anything like that before. We headed back up to my friend's house, and you turn on the local news where they were saying the WTO riots and how it'll affect parking downtown. I think that was really the first time that I understood the difference between reality and what mainstream press presented to the population.
That was a piece contributed by Jill Bolduc in Seattle. This week's program with a commentary on becoming the media from Michael Franti of the San Francisco-based band Spearhead.
My name is Michael Franti, and I want to say a few words about media and democracy. In November 1999, in the streets of Seattle, I saw something I'll never forget. Over 50,000 people from every background imaginable speaking truth to power as the tear gas, pepper spray, and rubber bullets rained on our heads. Over 50,000 of us made a joyful and passionate noise, demanding that human rights, justice, and protection of the environment be the priorities that guide global decisions, not merely corporate profits. While a group of corporate elites met behind closed doors, making decisions that would impact all of us. The corporate mainstream media had a different idea of what was happening in the streets of Seattle. Instead of focusing on the police brutality or the undemocratic nature of the WTO ministerial meetings, the corporate media focused on the, quote, rioting of the demonstrators, the destruction of property that in reality was only carried out by a handful of people. Talk to anyone who is participating in the protest and you'll hear about the colossal misrepresentation of this historic collective act of resistance. The corporate mainstream media put its own frame on the event and continues to use the same misleading language to this day. This happens to activists all the time. All around the globe. It's frustrating. But can we get angry with the media, or can we get even? We can become the media. We can do it ourselves. In the midst of the WTO protests, a new model for do-it-yourself democratic participatory media was born, the Independent Media Center. Using the website www.indymedia.org, activists, journalists, and just regular citizens were able to publish their own reports, photos, audio recordings, and videos directly and immediately to a worldwide audience. Now, 3 years later, Indie Media continues on as a decentralized international network of grassroots reporters, techies, and activists. There are currently over 100 independent media centers in countries around the world, helping community-based news and voices reach a global audience. And Indie Media is only one example in a growing movement of community media. Media that's people-driven, not profit-driven. Where we tell our own truths rather than relying on the lies and manipulations of the corporate media. Anti-corporate globalization activists know that another world is possible. And I believe that another media is possible too. So become the media, stay human, and power to the peaceful.
Listen Up Northwest is produced by Reclaim the Media at the studios of KBCS for the Northwest Community Radio Network. Find out more at nwcommunityradio.org. Thanks to contributors Charlotte Bourne, the KBCS Public Affairs team, Leela Katayev, and Peter Marshall. Music by Northwest artists DJ B-Girl, Danny Kogita, and Nola Club. Special thanks to Joaquin Wee, and thank you for listening to and supporting your community radio station. For Listen Up Northwest, this is Yuko Kodama.